Spirit Radio Podcasts.
The Health Service Executive has sent instructions to healthcare professionals notifying them of the shortcomings of fetal anomaly testing and telling them that pregnant women should be informed about these limitations. I covered this in the papers last week. The reason they've done this now is because earlier this year, an abortion was carried out in an Irish hospital on a perfectly healthy baby after the parents were told that their baby had a fetal anomaly. A later test after the abortion had been carried out showed that the baby was effectively healthy, an early casualty of Ireland's new abortion regime, I'm afraid. Well, on the line now to comment on the HSE's new instructions to healthcare professionals, we have Eilish Mulroy from the Pro-Life campaign. You're very welcome back to the show, Eilish. How are you?
Very well, thanks, Ronan. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, but first of all, Eilish, can you remind us what happened in this case?
Sure. Well, these instructions were prompted after a baby, as you said, was aborted earlier this year in the National Maternity Hospital in Holles Street after test results turned out to be incorrect. And the case first came to the public, into the public domain in May. The abortion actually happened in March. Mm. So just to recall, it was reported in the Irish Independent and other outlets at the time. Just to recall what happened, basically the parents were told that there was a chance of an anomaly after they had a private test near Holles Street and then a second test. They didn't request an abortion, but rather the first mention of abortion came from the hospital staff. And when the parents suggested holding off on the abortion until the final test results came back, the second test that you referred to earlier, they were told that there was no point and no hope for the baby. So that's what the media reports said at that time. And then in a further dramatic development, it has been alleged that after the abortion took place and the final test result subsequently came back showing that the baby was healthy, the full findings of those test results were withheld from the parents. So the parents now have legal representation. I suppose all of this is coming to light.
On a purely emotional level, that is an absolute disaster.
Yeah, and you know, it's a horrendous situation. And you know, the reality is that, you know, pro-life people warned before last year's referendum about the kind of unhealthy culture that existed around some sections of the medical community, and we were accused of scaremongering. We many people before the referendum, families of children who, people who had received misdiagnoses but who had carried on with their pregnancy because we didn't have a culture that said the answer to this misdiagnosis is automatically abortion. After their babies were born, had healthy babies, and the prognoses and the diagnoses were incorrect.
You're absolutely
right. That's not to say,
right,
let's remember that no matter what prognosis or diagnosis a baby has, you know, every baby deserves the right to life.
I had an experience of an interview that I did here in the studio during my first kind of stint here probably was around 2014 or 2015, and the lady was from outside the jurisdiction, but she'd ended up living here, and she said it was really interesting because she'd been given this kind of very dodgy, you know, fatal anomaly diagnosis outside, came here, and they went, well, look, we'll do our best for you, and she had a child with her when she was doing it, running around the studio, and I sort of said, so listen, what happened in the end? And she pointed to the child and went, that's the child, you know?
Yeah.
That's the child with the fatal anomaly running around the studio. It was absolutely extraordinary, you know?
And this is the issue, you know, there was a kind of a dismissive attitude on the part of some, you know, doctors towards the many parents who went public last year about their experiences and, you know, about the appalling treatment that some of them received from medics. I mean, look at this couple in the heart of this story. They didn't request it. It was suggested to them. They suggested holding off. They were told there was no point. So we urgently need a really open debate about the limitations of prenatal diagnosis and the way parents are treated when they receive this devastating news that their unborn baby might have a serious medical condition. And, you know, it's regrettable, but I really don't think right now we're ready for that debate, because anything that challenges the new regime, even really in the remotest sense, is ruled out of order by some of those who are in power. And that's not right. And I think, you know, we see all of the shortcomings within the medical situation, the health service, overcrowding, waiting lists, etc. And we have a government that only wants to engage with those who are on this topic supportive of abortion and refusing to listen to the experiences of those who have deeply harrowing stories to tell. And, you know, the result of that refusal to engage is that many more lives will be lost that could otherwise be saved.
Yeah, absolutely. Is it your sense, your hunch that you know, in such a short time, the culture has already changed? Or do you think there was genuine panic and people just felt like, well, you know, there's no point in going ahead? I mean, what is your sense of what happened here?
But this particular case, I think that, you know, once you have, you know, law shapes behavior, and once you say thing is in law is acceptable, people start to, I suppose, accept that instead of relying on their own instincts. I think the instinct of any parent and the instinct of these parents would be to do their very best to give their child the best chance, and that clearly was their instinct.
The reason I ask is because this particular woman that I had in the studio with me was saying in the place she'd come from, it was a no-brainer, get rid of the child. Whereas immediately, because the culture was different in Ireland, she kind of, it got her to second guess herself because she wasn't from here, and she went, okay, sure, we'll see how it ends up, you know, and it turned out wonderful for her. So it's just interesting that a culture can really change very fast, is what you're saying.
And we've heard many, many examples of that, leaving aside just the issue of diagnosis of life-limiting conditions. Just generally speaking, people who are in unplanned pregnancy situations, where in Ireland, the natural kind of reaction was, you can do it, let's support you, you know, let's get you all the help you need. Whereas now there's a different kind of natural reaction. And that's very, very regrettable. And I think that can change. But we definitely have a challenge, I suppose, with the current government, where there's a constant push on this topic, so much so that, you know, we're not seeing any investment in positive support for women in unplanned pregnancy. And that's something that we all should be working towards, supporting women, supporting families, especially those who are vulnerable. Look at all the stories of homeless women, homeless pregnant women. That's totally unacceptable in 2019. Yeah. And really, our government needs to get their priorities right.
Can I ask you, do you suspect that there may be other similar cases like this that just haven't been reported?
Absolutely. And I'm sure there's many similar cases that even the people directly involved and directly affected by them don't know about. Yeah. We know that after this test came back, showing that the baby was healthy, those findings were withheld from the parents. That's reported.
They knew they'd done something wrong, so they went, listen, let's not tell the parents. And can you remember how it was that the parents came to be told in the end?
You know what, I just can't think right this minute about how they came
to be
told in the end.
They
found out in due course. The other thing that's interesting about this is Paul Cullen reported in the Irish Times in the last couple of days, you know, the fact that the solicitor for the women, for the couple, has asked for an independent review of the case. Okay, so there's obviously trust issues there, and they want an independent review of the case, which is a correct course of action.
Absolutely.
And it's a course of action you would take in any area of medicine where there's been a misdiagnosis.
Yeah.
And eight months after the abortion, remember this abortion was last March, 8 months after, that promised independent review has yet to begin because of internal disagreements over the composition of the review panel. That's what was reported in the Irish Times three days ago. So that's interesting in itself. In any other area of life, any other area where there's a misdiagnosis or to this extent that a life was lost as a result of this, I think rightly people would be calling for an immediate investigation as to what happened. And the fact that 8 months on there's no investigation suggests there's more questions to be answered among, you know, the medical community, and, you know, the government itself and the Minister for Health and the Taoiseach should be saying more about this.
You mentioned, Eilish, that the possibility of this sort of error was flagged during the referendum campaign, and it, you know, it was kind of a bit poo-pooed, if I remember correctly. But would you like to see more done?
Absolutely. It's not just in Ireland. This is a case worldwide. There are always shortcomings with any, you know, testing. There's always a need for double checking and triple checking. And, you know, the fact that this was seen to have been pushed in a kind of a way that was just not prudent and not conscious enough and not considerate enough of the implications of the decision to abort that baby, is just heartbreaking. So it's really important that we have a proper debate. And, you know, the opposition and members of the opposition should be calling on the government to clarify, to really bring to light what happened in this case, investigate if it's happened in other situations, and make sure it doesn't happen again. But let's not forget, you know, whether the baby has a condition that could shorten his or her life, or any kind of disability, you know, let's try and bring about a situation where we welcome every baby and we protect every baby in law.
Yeah. On a related matter, we heard this week too that the Rotunda Hospital is bursting at the seams and that one baby has died as a result of overcrowding and infection and all the rest. Do you think that the changes arising from new abortion laws is adding to pressures at the maternity hospitals?
Absolutely. There's no question about that. I mean, we hear every day about huge pressures on hospitals, on A&E, all over the country. But I think, you know, it's ironic that the, you know, the master of the Rotunda is warning that babies' lives are at risk in his hospital. And kind of my first reaction on hearing that is, you know, does he not get what's so contradictory and out of place about those comments? Because, you know, abortions have been happening in his hospital since the 1st of January. But look, certainly no one would disagree that the issue of overcrowding in maternity hospitals needs to be urgently addressed. But I think an awful lot of people would like to hear a more, you know, consistent and coherent message from some of our leading doctors about the need for respect for human life. And there's nothing consistent or coherent about wanting to protect the lives of babies in one wing of the Rotunda while overseeing the ending of the lives of babies in another wing of the same hospital.
Yeah. Eilish Mulroy from the Pro-Life Campaign, thank you so much for talking to us.
Thank you, Ronan.
God bless you. Now, earlier this week, it was announced that drivers will now be fined and given 3 penalty points for dangerously overtaking a cyclist. The Department of Transport says it will particularly target those drivers who put cyclists at risk. And Minister for Transport Shane Ross stated that Gardaí will be vigilant in their approach to the new rules. On the line to tell us more, we have Colm Ryder, chairperson of Cyclist.ie, the Irish Cycling Advocacy Network. And you're very welcome to the show, Colm. How are you?
Thank you very much, Ronan.
Yeah, great. Well, first of all, Colm, what do we know about the new laws that aim to better protect cyclists on the road?
Well, essentially, the law has been, it's been a long time in gestation. It's been talked about, it's been rolled about the place. It went through the guards, it went through the Attorney General's office, it went through various various offices of government offices. But it's because of the number of cyclists that have been seriously injured or killed on the roads in the last number of years. It's for us as cyclists, or anybody as cyclists, anybody who does cycle, any people who cycle, it's a frightening figure. And this law was brought about as a result of lobbying from a number of people, particularly from our organisation and from an organisation called Staying Alive at 1.5. The idea being that drivers should keep a safe distance from cyclists. That sometimes drivers who don't cycle don't understand
I agree.
What it is to be close past.
Yeah, I totally agree. I remember very vividly as a cyclist those juggernauts, and I used to drive along the Clonkeen Road, and the juggernauts come right in beside you, and they would suck you in. You know, they're so terrifying.
Yes, it's like as Phil Skelton, the great campaigner down in Wexford, has said, like, if you stand in the yellow area on a train platform, you know, on an Irish rail platform. And the train actually just goes past you and doesn't stop. You then know exactly how it feels on a bicycle.
That's very good. That's a really good, actually. It's a brilliant kind of analogy there.
Yes.
What I suppose I encountered, you know, both on Twitter and, you know, in the newspapers and stuff, was some of the cyclists kind of thought this new law might be just a little bit of, you know, it kind of was a little bit of fluff. It's not really going to make any amount of difference. What's your own sense of it?
Look, as far as we are concerned in Cyclist.ie, and we are the advocacy network for cyclists all around the country, there's lots of networks, groups in various cities. Anything in a positive move is good, and this is a positive move. And the awareness levels of drivers need to grow. I mean, it's a small minority of drivers who are unaware or who drive dangerously or are not patient enough. And that's what this law is aimed at. So it does make it has made a bit of difference. We think, certainly, even from the Road Safety Authority TV ads that have happened anecdotally around the country. I mean, cyclists are getting they're saying overall that they are getting more space from drivers.
Right. I mean, yeah, so do you think those TV ads and stuff have actually had some sort of impact?
That is the feedback that we are getting from around the country.
Okay. It was funny, I was just talking to Steve Johnson, our producer here, and he was saying, you know, at this time of year, the fact that there's no attempt made to clean leaves off cycle lanes, and they are just killer when you're on two wheels, aren't they?
Yes. Oh, well, look, the general maintenance of cycle tracks and cycle lanes is an issue, which we take up with local authorities all the time. It's just, it obviously makes it more difficult, you know, in all kinds of conditions, wet conditions, even in dry conditions when you have a lot of material, a lot of loose material on the cycle track, you can get punctures, you can skid, all of those kind of things. Mm. So it's just important for local authorities to do their job.
Yeah. Colm, any sense, you know, at the moment of a move around the country to become a cycling nation? Or is it on the increase? Are there more people cycling? Is there more of a sense of, you know, priorities around cycling? Any of that stuff?
Obviously, cycling has grown in the last number of years for a lot of different reasons. Obviously, if you're a worker, you do have the opportunity of buying a bike and getting a tax break on it. So it's a support for buying a bike, and that has certainly led to more people getting on the bicycle. In Dublin City, where the figures are measured on a yearly basis, there has been a growth in cycling. The cycling numbers have doubled in the past 6 years, approximately, in terms of going in and out of the city to commuting. At the same time, also, of course, people on traveling on buses and people traveling on public transport has increased, while the number of cars coming into the city centre during the morning has decreased.
Okay, well, that's not a bad sign, you know. What should cyclists be mindful of in terms of keeping safe on the roads during the darker, colder winter months?
Well, overall, and obviously, it's important for cyclists to obey the laws.
Sure.
In the dark nights, I mean, be safe, be seen. Where, you know, you certainly should have lights. Bright lights that make sure that you can be seen on the road when you're on the road. It's really important. You are a vehicle on the road, the same as a car is a vehicle, although they're very different types of vehicle. But it is very important that cyclists have lights on their bikes. That's the most important thing. Be clearly seen. Be able to be seen. Otherwise, you're putting your life in danger. And secondly, you're actually breaking the law, and you can be fined. There's an on-the-spot fine for cyclists not having their lights at €45.
Yeah, I mean, it really is terrifying. I'm thinking from the point of view of, no, I'm in a slightly different situation. I live up in the hills, up in Roundwood. So we get a lot of, I suppose, what you call leisure cyclists rather than people who are, you know, kind of rushing in and out. Where it is a very different kind of a cyclist. But you get a lot of people who have, like, headlights and don't have them on the bike. So, you know, from the distance, you don't know what you're seeing. You don't know you know it's something, but you're not sure what it is. And it's very confusing. It can be very confusing, whereas actually if you have somebody who's got a properly lit bike, you kind of look at it and go, that's a bike, you know? I don't know, so it's important. And so can you just tell me, is the law around having any light of any kind, or is it a light? When I say a headlight, I mean a light or a band around your head, you know, that shows a light. Or is it, can you have that? Or is a bike supposed to have, look, something on the front, something on the back, you know, reflectors, all, is that part of the law, is it?
Part of the law to have a front light and a back light.
Yeah, right. Okay, well, there you go. And that's often missing. What about cyclists who don't use the cycle lane facilities, or, you know, like cycling two abreast where there really is only space for one and that kind of thing? It can create kind of problems, can't it?
Yes, of course. Certainly the law does enable cyclists to, you know, the law says you can cycle two abreast.
Sure.
But obviously that it must be done with respect, the same as any person in any vehicle needs to respect how they use the road. That's
sure.
Just important. It's you don't want to cause tension
yeah.
Between drivers of cars and bikes. I mean, we would advise cyclists just to use the common sense and be respectful of other users of the road.
Yeah, it's about consideration both directions, really, I often think.
Absolutely.
And you know, I remember one thing, somebody saying, you know, think car, think bike. And they were talking about motorbikes, but I often do it for cyclists as well. It's like, just think it's a car, you know. If you think it's a car, you'll give it space, you know, when you're passing it out or when you're, you know, when it's coming in the opposite
direction.
Yeah,
good point there, yes.
So for those who don't cycle, what do you think is stopping them? I mean, what would you say to encourage people to get cycling?
Well, it's interesting because we are talking with the Road Safety Authority in relation to driver training overall, and I know it's happened in some other countries where anybody, even as part of your driving test, that you are encouraged to get on a bicycle and experience what it's like on the road.
Wow.
As a cyclist.
Yeah.
So that you have that experience and understanding of other vulnerable users of the road when you're driving. And in fact, most cyclists, most adult cyclists, that is, are also drivers. I mean, I drive cars. I'm not just a cyclist. I'm a person who cycles. I'm a person who drives a car.
Exactly, yeah.
I'm a person who walks. And that is the basic thing. But most cyclists drive, but most drivers do not all cycle.
Yeah.
And I think that's really critical to understand just how the road works and how people on the road work. And generally, it has been, from studies in other countries, it has been shown that cyclists are better drivers.
Yeah.
On the whole.
Yeah, I can imagine, because obviously you're very aware of the fragility of the cyclist, the pedestrian, all that kind of thing. And I'm doing a lot of, as I was saying to you, a lot of country roads driving, and you're very, very aware, like around every single corner you think could be a cyclist, and you know, you just drive a very different way. You do make a good point though, Colm, you know, that in the sense that the vast bulk of people who cycle, adults who cycle, are also drivers. So they've already done the rules of the road. But I was just thinking, there probably are a few cyclists who may never have had to sit down with a book of the rules of the road the way you would do if you were doing a kind of a driving test. I wonder, do you think it would be useful to have something in that area for cyclists to say, look, you know, just here's the rules of the road and this is what you should do, or what you should, you know, or even a cyclist's version of the rules of the road, which involves a lot more hand signals or something like that. Do you think that would be helpful?
Well, yeah, for instance, there is a program called Cycle Right, which is a national cycle training program. And that is a program. It's basically, at this point in time, it's mainly geared towards children in schools, because there is a fear that the next generation will not be able to cycle, won't cycle as much.
Yeah.
I mean, you may well be aware of the so-called obesity epidemic.
Absolutely, of course, yeah.
That children are not getting enough exercise. I mean, reading the other day about children of 10 and 12 who can't even jump up and down because they're just so unfit, so fat, obese. And it's something that is growing in this country, and people need to get out more generally cycling and walking, being active. So the Cycle Right program is part of the idea of getting more children, first of all, to get used to the bike, but they're also now doing courses for adults as well, and that's just as important. I mean, and so it introduces those elements of the road and how to behave on the road and what you need to do and what you should not do.
Exactly. A little text in here on 087-888-9292 from Robert. Ronan, it should be mandatory for motorists to have their right indicator on while awaiting an opportunity to safely pass a cyclist. This would prevent other impatient drivers in second or third place behind the leading car from overtaking the car and the bicycle. This overtaking could cause a possible serious collision. I have actually been in exactly that situation. It's dangerous, isn't it?
Yes, well, I certainly, again, I would sort of use the rule of common sense.
I
mean, the rules of the road say if you're passing out, you should use your indicator. So that's,
yeah, absolutely.
That's just it should be done.
And a final thought there. In the Netherlands, all bicycles are registered. They have an ID plate and are required to have a head and taillights, and they also need a cert of safe roadworthiness. So that's the Dutch for you, you know?
Yes, yes. Absolutely. Well, the Dutch are certainly a cycling nation.
Yeah,
we've a long way to go to reach that level.
Listen, Colm, it's been a pleasure speaking to you. Thank you very much just for giving us your thoughts on these new developments in terms of road safety and cycling and all the rest. Colm Ryder, chairperson of cyclist.ie, the Irish Cycling Advocacy Network. Thank you so much for talking to us this morning.
Okay. God bless you.
Our next guests are religious sisters from the United States. As women who have made a decision to remain single for life, they will never be mothers, but they see themselves as having a role as spiritual mothers, especially reaching out to those in crisis pregnancy and those seeking hope and healing after abortion. In studio now to tell us more about their life less ordinary, we have Sister Joan Mary and Sister Giovanna from Sisters of Life. You are both very, very welcome to the show, sisters. How are you?
Thank you, Ronan. Great.
So first of all, can you tell us a little bit about yourselves? Where are you from?
Sure.
Oh, you're going to do the talking. Okay. There's this lovely little look and the eye went straight over to the left.
I am Canadian. I'm very happy to be here in Ireland.
What part of Canada are you from, sister?
I'm from the city called Calgary, which is in Western Canada.
Yeah, lovely.
Near the Canadian Rockies.
Absolutely.
It's gorgeous.
Gorgeous.
And, my family came by way of India, Africa, spent a little time in England and Wales, and then I was born and raised in Canada. So I'm now living in New York with the sisters.
Absolutely. And how about you, sister?
Sure, I'm from Florida, in the north, so close to the ocean.
Near Jacksonville or?
Right there in the middle, actually. Yeah, wow. Way to go, Tallahassee.
Oh, Tallahassee, okay, yeah. Right, okay. Yeah. I've toured. That's really good. So, beautiful part of the world as well. Both of you from beautiful parts of the world, different. Mm-hmm. So as religious sisters, you made a commitment to remain single and live a form of community life. How does that work? Can you give me an idea of what that looks like?
I think the vocation to be a sister is to be a bride, to be a mother. It's a vocation of love. So each of us have fallen in love, you know, with Jesus in a particular way, but it's his initiative. You know, he calls some to be religious sisters, and it's true, we're single, but we very much are espoused to the Lord. We've fallen in love, and we want to repay his love. And the church, you know, for centuries, millennium, has had a way of life as religious sisters of prayer, of ministry, that expresses that love. So our community has a particular form of that, but it's very much a way of life, a beautiful history in the church.
And you do that kind of classic monastic thing of the poverty, chastity, obedience as well, yeah?
Yes. Yeah, we take three vows, poverty, chastity, and obedience. Our particular community, the Sisters of Life, takes a fourth vow to witness and protect human life as well.
Wow. Now that is something, particularly in this day and age, isn't it? Because there's kind of a sea change, I think, you know, forgive me, but, you know, there's a kind of a feeling where that human life is kind of, I suppose it's been devalued more and more as time goes on. So to have people who make it their kind of vocation to value that human life, that's really kind of, you're really swimming against the tide there. Mm-hmm. Would you agree?
Mm-hmm. Most definitely. That was the sense that our founder had, Cardinal O'Connor. He was the Archbishop of New York.
I remember,
Yeah, so he was a beautiful champion for life, and he had a powerful experience, I think before he became a bishop, close to that, and he went to Dachau to make a retreat and pray in there. He had an experience of beautiful grace given to him by the Lord of being before the brick ovens, you know, the crematoria, and just being pierced to the heart, like, oh my gosh, how could people do this to one another? How could people do this? And so he made a vow, you know, to whatever I do for the rest of my life, I want to uphold the dignity and beauty and glory of every human life. And that was kind of the seedbed for the charism, really, and for our community, which was founded about maybe 10 years later after that.
So the community was founded, and how many of you were there at the time of the founding? Was it a large, a small group?
Yeah, just a small group of eight sisters.
Right, and were you both around at that time?
No. We both came in 2005. We entered together.
Okay, wow. And it grew from eight, did it?
Yes, we are now 116.
My goodness, that's really exciting. So you're are you all over the world? Are you still like based mainly in the New York area?
In the New York area. Yeah. We also have convents in Denver, in Washington D.C., Philadelphia, and Toronto, Canada.
Wow, that's a good mix. And now Ireland.
Well, we're here now, but
we're here to take a look.
We keep teaching that we're going to lose our passport.
I'm just a little word from the Lord for you. And we spoke to this guy on the radio, and he said, and I'm just talking, some religious orders focus on education and others on healthcare and others on mission to the poor. And in your case, your mission, as you said, is to uphold respect for life. Mm-hmm. Can you give me an idea of what that looks like? How do you do that, sure, you know, in a vocational way?
Well, day to day, we have a rhythm of prayer and work, but it all goes to serve the witness of human life. And so our ministry is varied, but it's all based on communicating the dignity of the human person. So that takes the form of serving pregnant women who are in crisis, vulnerable to abortion, don't know what they're going to do, need support.
And how do you serve them?
So we have a convent where women can actually live with us right in New York City, a couple blocks from Times Square. And for 20 years, we've welcomed women pregnant and in need of housing, of support, and they get to live with us. And, you know, we don't have a program, a particular way. It's loving them so they can love their children.
And tell us, what kind of condition do they come to you in? Well, like, what are you dealing with? Yeah, as they come across the door, what are they like?
Everything. You have women who are in college age. You know, their college hasn't been able to provide any support for them. Women whose families have abandoned them, or, you know, their significant others, spouses, boyfriends. We have a huge immigrant population we're serving, you know. So anything and everything. The wealthy, the poor, Catholic, non-Catholic, faith, no faith. Anyone is welcome, you know, just like Jesus' heart, anyone's welcome there.
And do you get the feeling that the people who come to you kind of know that you have this value on life? You know, I mean, they know they're not coming to an abortion facility, is what I'm saying. Yeah. Do you get a sense that they have that kind of expectation, or do they literally not know what they're coming to?
Oh, gosh, I guess it depends sometimes, sister. You know how they find out about us.
Sometimes it's both. Some approach us as sisters. They know that we're part of the church and they know our work. Sometimes they're just looking for help, practical help. I need a place to live. And then they encounter, hopefully, a whole world of Christ's love. But it depends. Sometimes people come to our crisis pregnancy mission and they don't know we're sisters. They've just found us on the internet or looked us up, and then we opened the door, and
they're like,
here we are.
Brilliant.
Yeah.
Brilliant.
There's one story, the woman who found us actually at an abortion clinic. She was there, you know, and she was thinking about having an abortion and I think getting ready for it, and was in the waiting room and just did not feel at peace, did not feel at peace at all. Saw our literature, actually. I don't know how it ended up in an abortion clinic.
Wow.
But looked over.
That's a miracle.
And she's like, oh my gosh, there's hope.
Wow.
There's something else. There's another choice. There's hope, you know. So she left and she came to us. So it's,
you know, it's such a good thing, because, you know, there's an awful lot. I mean, look, we're just out of this kind of, it's been like a spasm in Ireland because of the changing of the law. And, you know, we I suppose you could say, if for a long time people would look at Ireland and go, well, at least Ireland doesn't allow abortions and that. And on one hand, you know, on the other hand, you had a lot of people who were pro-life and thought that was a good thing, and people who were pro-choice and thought that was a bad thing. But what I was going to say is, in the middle of the changing of that law, and, you know, and there's a massive grief amongst the people who are pro-life and people feeling like something terrible has been lost and all that kind of thing. But one of the things that really came about when all the shouting had died down was the feeling that there is no way that you can really, in all justice, in all morality, in all ethics, say to somebody, look, this is the morally right thing to do, and give them no help to do it.
Exactly.
If you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And that kind of what you're doing is by saying to people, like, that was what I was left with. It's like when you say, am I prepared to take your baby? Am I prepared to, you know, support you while you go through that pregnancy? That's really, a pro-life person should be prepared to do that.
Yes,
shouldn't
absolutely.
They?
Absolutely.
I think speaking the truth about human life without mercy or without the pastoral care it can be violent to people to tell
exactly.
them what the truth of the church's teaching is, but then are you willing to help me?
Yeah.
You
know, I mean, it's kind of something kind of glib and brutal and judgmental, actually.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you know, lecturing people about what they should do. So I just find that ministry that you have is beautiful, really, for that reason.
Yeah, I think it just touches their hearts in a way, because it's a communication, not through words, but by presence, that you're not alone and you never have to be alone. You know, that's, I guess, how women feel when they're pregnant and everyone kind of walks away or they don't know what to do. And she's like, I'm all alone. I have no other choice, but we're going to walk with you every step of the way. And it's not only material goods, those are a help, but they just really want a friend. They want someone who believes in them and is going to be with them every step of the way. And when we continue that, it's all relationship based, and not just while they're pregnant, but even afterwards. And we have great Christmas parties where women will come back with their children.
And now for 20 years, there's hundreds of them that we've served, thousands actually, in New York and beyond.
My goodness.
They stay in touch with us. They're part of our extended family. So our ministry really is accompaniment. We accompany young people, university students who want to know the church's teaching and live it and want to know Jesus. We accompany pregnant women seeking healing after having had an abortion and really wanting to know, is the mercy of Jesus for me personally, and will he forgive me? And the answer is yes.
And it's, you know, that idea that, you know, the post-abortion trauma that actually people literally can't forgive themselves. And it's really amazing to be able to have such and I can sense from you both that there's a beautiful presence there. I was thinking to myself, just as, you know, we started off the interview talking about spiritual mothers, yeah? And I was thinking, you know, I have two kids in their teens, and I was thinking, I'm great, as you can probably imagine, I'm very gobby, and I do a lot of talking to them, but their mother is brilliant on the presence. She transforms by her presence. Mm. And it's not that she doesn't know, she's well capable of talking, but that's really, when I look at her with them, I go, that's fabulous. What's going on there is, and I bet you're the same. I bet you get to be spiritual mothers on lots of levels in that way.
It's a tremendous privilege and a gift. And it's like, you know, as sisters of life, we've fallen in love with Christ, and he is life.
Yeah.
And it's like our spiritual maternity, it's gorgeous. I mean, to see Christ's life come alive in these souls, you know, whether they're alone and pregnant or have suffered the trauma, like you said, it's the trauma of abortion, to see his life come alive in them is so beautiful, and to be a part of that, it's a great privilege.
So, as you said, you haven't set up a community here yet, but what was, seriously, I'm joking, yeah, what are you going to be doing during your visit to Ireland? What's on there?
Well, we're here for this weekend for the Blessed Is She Retreat.
Oh,
it's an
absolutely,
American
yeah.
Retreat ministry.
Yeah.
And so we're eager to be with, I think, 200 women this weekend, tell them about Jesus' love, their vocation as women. And then, because we're over here, we're going to take the opportunity to see a bit of Ireland, to travel, to meet with some Catholic ministries and pro-life groups. And I should mention as well, we do have one of our 116 sisters is from County Limerick.
Ah.
And so
brilliant.
We'll be visiting her family there.
Lovely.
Just to get a sense of the church and the culture here.
Lovely, lovely. Well, Sister John Mary and Sister Giovanna from Sisters of Life, thank you so much for talking to us today.
Thank you.
And the website is sistersoflife.org.
Absolutely. There's lots of videos, podcasts, materials. Our imprint magazine is available online, and just beautiful stories of God's grace.
Wow. I'm going straight there now. God bless you. There's no denying that Ireland has changed a lot over the past number of decades. We've gone through wealth during the Celtic Tiger years, followed by the recent economic crisis. We've become an increasingly multicultural country, a country where society is changing. Defining issues have changed our culture, how life is lived, and some consider the country is changing in terms of its values. Now, our next guest has written a book that explores how the radical, life-changing good news of Jesus addresses the questions of our society and the things, I suppose, society is asking. The book looks at topics including Jesus in a progressive culture and salvation in a skeptical culture. On the line now to tell us more, we have Dr. Fraser Hosford, author of Down With This Sort of Thing, How Is the Gospel Good News in Contemporary Culture? You are very welcome to the show, Fraser. How you doing, man?
Doing well. Thanks, Ronan, and thanks for having me on. Great to be here.
Yeah, great. First of all, Fraser, you serve as a pastor in Dublin. What are some of the significant challenges in contemporary society that you've witnessed and reflected on when you've been writing this book?
Yeah, I mean, obviously, there's all sorts of challenges in society people face physically and economically. I mean, the book, I guess, focuses more on people's view of faith as Ireland has changed. It's quite a negative view of faith. And I guess the challenge for me and my desire in writing the book, as you said, the subtitle is How Is the Gospel Good News? And the desire for me was, you know, in chatting to people in daily life, friends, colleagues, people I know, a lot of them had the sense that the gospel was bad news.
And
faith or religion has come across as bad news.
Yeah.
And that's just a reality. I think if, you know, if we mingle with people, we come across that. And that has to be a huge challenge to us as people who follow Jesus, that we have to think, well, how can we recast the gospel? How can we put it across in fresh ways and get away from that cloud that is there over faith and religion in our land?
Yeah, I remember very early days when Eddie Izzard was on the scene for the very first time, and he said, how did we reduce this God of the universe to mumbling in tall buildings?
Yeah.
And I remember thinking, you might have a point, my friend. So tell us about this book and why you decided to write the book on this topic.
Yeah, so it's coming from that experience of people having experienced faith and religion as bad news. And then as part of that, we've sort of moved on as a society to value different things. Freedom and choice and all sorts of other things are valued ahead of faith and religion. And so just really want to engage with them. There are things that Jesus speaks about. There are things that the gospel speaks to. So I think, you know, it starts off in some of the early chapters are talking about how we talk about faith in a post-religious culture. And just acknowledging that we've changed, and a part of that is due to people's negative experiences of faith, and trying to speak to that. And I was just, you know, speaking to friends, they've always been amazed when we've had chats about faith, whatever, and they've given out about religion or something. And I've said, oh yeah, Jesus always gave out about religion.
Yeah,
sort of
exactly.
A bit shocked by that.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
And I'm like, well, the people he clashed with most were the religious people.
Yeah.
And they're not quite sure what to do with that. And like, surprise is always great in any conversation, because then people sort of reflect a bit more when you surprise them with something.
Yeah, it was funny. I remember speaking to somebody recently, and she's a professor of theology, and she went, you know, increasingly, I wonder if Christianity is a religion at all. And I thought, what are you talking about? He says, well, if it's really essentially a relationship, that, you know, it doesn't really fit the bill of other religions. And I thought, wow, that was a brilliant way of saying it, you know?
Yeah, no, exactly. And I think that's, you know, how we have to sort of put it across in today's world. Religion is seen as a bad thing. We're not going to necessarily change that. But what we want to talk about is Jesus. So just sort of explore that. And I, you know, as you said, I'm a pastor in a local church. In Dublin, and as part of that, we're coming up with, you know, these passages where Jesus encountered the religious, say that the Pharisees in his day, and just sort of follow that train of thought as to how does he engage with them, what do they say with them, what does he disagree about, and trying to apply that then to our day. Well, what would that say about how we engage in a culture which has sort of had enough of religion? So follow that train of thought, and that's a couple of chapters in the book, and I think it's quite interesting for us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, so how can we as Christians respond to that? I mean, I get what your diagnosis is.
Yeah.
So what's the prescription?
Yeah. Well, on that front, I think it's to have a very sharp distinction between Jesus and religion.
Yeah.
I mean, in John chapter 10, a famous passage in scriptures where Jesus called himself the Good Shepherd, and he's calling himself the Good Shepherd in opposition to thieves and robbers.
Yeah.
But I, a few years ago, reading that passage and to speak on it, was amazed that actually the thieves and robbers he's talking about are the Pharisees.
Yeah,
and that
right.
In this stark, you know,
it's a shocker, isn't it? Yeah.
It is a complete shocker. And I'd grown up being told that was Satan he was talking about here, but it's not. The context is the Pharisees.
It's clearly the Pharisees.
And so Jesus, when he defines who he is in public, starting a bit of a skirmish, he defines himself in opposition to religion.
Yeah.
And slamming religion in pretty stark terms. I mean, thieves and robbers, he's not holding back there.
Sorry for interrupting you there, Fraser, but yet we have this very interesting, I suppose, you know, it's a kind of contradiction in some senses, that he was perfectly happy to turn up to the synagogue, perfectly happy to go up to Jerusalem to the temple.
Yeah,
he was prepared to do those kinds of religious things, break bread, to do the Sabbath, to do the Passover, and yet at the same time to do it in a way that completely turns it on its head.
No, that's very good. And I think it's great that there's a real nuance to who Jesus was and to how we relate to people and to his teaching. And I think if we can, you know, engage where people are, if there's an anti-religious mood, and go in and talk about how Jesus was not religious and then fight the religious, but then as our conversations develop, that nuance comes out that obviously he still believed in Yahweh, he still believed in God, he still tried to follow God. And when that comes out, you get to see more. I mean, I've exploring that Pharisee team through the New Testament. You see in Matthew 23, when he sort of lays into the Pharisees and for the whole chapter, this nuance comes out where he talks about the problem of injustice and stuff is in people's hearts, that the inside hasn't been washed out, the inside of the cup versus the outside, and religion doesn't touch the inside.
Yeah,
but he actually talks,
but
he also says religion can make things worse. Now, he's talking about a religion without God.
Sure,
you know,
absolutely.
An empty religion. That's what he's talking about.
Yeah.
Be clear.
What some people would call religiosity, I suppose.
Exactly. But he says it can make it worse. You know, and Paul talks about, he uses the word garbage for religious acts, you know, in the book of Philippians. So we shouldn't be afraid to do that. But then at the same time, that leads you on to the good news that actually Jesus can change the inside, and religion can't, and other things can't.
Absolutely. I get the book from this book that the aim was to put forward suggestions for kind of gospel opportunities in the country, which is obviously focusing, as you say, on good news. So, you know, the idea, I suppose, that kind of hope for future, which is real and true and, you know, not based on nonsense, as it were.
Yeah, Yeah, exactly. And so after, I guess the early chapters focus on this sort of post-religious thing, but then moving on to sort of the contemporary values and how Jesus and his teachings can speak into them. So their values of freedom and choice in our land, and their values of sort of individualism and expressing yourself, and then values that we associate with our sort of progressive culture, you know, acceptance would be a prime value. And just really talks about how those things, those values are, to get the true depth and richness of those values, of what freedom really is, what acceptance is, they're really Jesus values.
Absolutely.
And Jesus, and so tries to then explore that these are real connection points for us. And, you know, the words and the concepts here are ultimately of Jesus. And if we can connect and show how Jesus gives a deeper or a richer acceptance, I mean, or freedom, or whatever the particular value is. But you take the value of acceptance, and we talk about it a lot, but at the same time, we have, like, social media and all sorts of stuff happening there. And,
absolutely.
So you have this irony in modern culture where acceptance is something we talk about, and it lays behind some of the larger changes in society in recent years, and referendum, and it's a good value. But yeah, at the same time, personal acceptance on a personal level is there's all sorts of animosity in how we express ourselves and communicate.
Yeah, there's kind of ways in which we kind of push back. You know, and you know what I mean? It's almost like there's a kind of a passive aggressive thing in us that even though we might be doing the right thing, we're kind of pushing back at the same time. And it's like to almost get to that very heart, the core of ourselves, where our motivations lie, and really let him purify that. You know, I was going to say, Fraser, you know, the book is filled with biblical insights and with reflections and questions that will challenge the reader. You know, was this an important element for you, kind of setting out to write the book, that it wouldn't just be a simply kind of a collection of statements, but that there would be something that would draw the reader in and try and get them to do something, to hassle something?
Yeah, I mean, I think for me, as you said, I've been a pastor for about 10 years, so, you know, the thoughts have percolated over those years, and that's where it's come from, you know, speaking to people in church, and then just friends and colleagues from other jobs outside of church, and that's formed them. And really, I guess the audience primarily is for Christians to try and think through how do we engage in contemporary Ireland. Like, I still believe firmly the good news is good news, but do we say it as good news? Do we express the whole depth of the gospel? And because particular aspects, it might be more good news for today than they were for yesterday. You know, but also I think, you know, I've some friends who don't go to church who've picked it up as well and find it interesting to read things expressed in a big way. So,
well done, man. That's brilliant.
Well, we'll see. Yeah. But I guess the real thing is it's taking the scriptures and the culture and trying to put the two together to reflect. So there's obviously the title's taken from Father Ted. There's a couple of Father Ted quotes in
brilliant.
There.
Yeah, absolutely.
There's some, you know, Bono quotes from songs, and then there's Irish history references and other cultural references.
Yeah.
And then there's biblical insights interwoven into that.
Can I just say to you, it's a lovely book. It's presented beautifully. It's well written, and it's a really nice, you know, like in your hand, it's lovely, and really, and I like a book that's not too small, decent space on it, and just everything, the types, everything is lovely on it. Topics in the book, you've got Jesus in a progressive culture and salvation in a skeptical culture, God in an expressive culture. I mean, there's just a lot to get your teeth into, and it's not a particularly long book either. I mean, it's just kind of give or take 100 pages. So what do you hope people will take with them from reading this book?
I hope that, I guess maybe the principle of trying to reevaluate how we talk about the good news and Jesus in today's culture, just to that principle of listening to where people are at, of listening, you know, I mean, which is ultimately founded on what we call the incarnation, that God came to earth and became a person in Jesus. So he came close. And as we get close to people, get close to culture and listen to them, then we can hear what their questions are and try and answer those actual real questions.
Absolutely.
So that's the principle, and I hope people will appreciate that. And then also some of the examples I've done. I don't have all the answers, clearly.
Yeah. Sure. I know, but it's, you asked the questions in a very, very good way. I'm just going to give a couple of the quotes on the back there. Sean Mullen, founder of Third Space Social Enterprise, says, Fraser Hosford wades into what could be a particularly boggy field with humour, insight, honesty and courage. Our old friend Ruth Garvey Williams there, the editor of Vox, Down With This Sort of Thing, explores how the radical, life-changing good news of Jesus addresses the questions of our society is asking and suggests why old paradigms are failing to connect with modern Ireland. So listen, Fraser, whereabouts is it available and how can people get their hands on it?
Yeah, so the main place is to go to Amazon, amazon.co.uk, and you'll find it there, paperback. It's about £9, or the Kindle version for £6. So they're online,
right.
And we're at the moment it's coming into a few bookshops, certainly around Dublin at the moment as well.
Great.
But Amazon is your best spot for the moment.
So it's called Down With This Sort of Thing. It's by Fraser Hosford, Dr. Fraser Hosford, author of Down With This Sort of Thing: How Is the Gospel Good News in Contemporary Culture? Thank you so much for talking to us today. God bless
you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.